Yes, I'll be talking about the evolving quantum state for black holes, and this is based on work that appeared in a short paper last year and another paper in preparation, and also some work with a UCSB student, Julie Perkins, some ongoing work in progress. So the starting point, let's assume that there is a quantum mechanical theory of gravity. Of course, that's what many of us believe and are after and are trying to understand. And if there is such a theory, one of the biggest puzzles about that theory is how black holes behave in such a theory. In fact, I've for some time believed that this is such a fundamental problem for quantum gravity that it should in fact be a guide to the underlying physics of quantum gravity. I think more and more people have adopted that viewpoint over time as well, that this really is a key problem for understanding some of the basic properties of quantum gravity. Well, we of course have an asymptotic description of how they behave, and that goes back to the work of Hawking. And so we have the basic picture, which I think pretty much everyone here is probably familiar with, where you have collapse, say, of matter to form a black hole, and you describe the production of Hawking radiation. Ultimately, you typically describe the asymptotic state of the outgoing Hawking radiation. And so this picture has played an important role in our discussion. And of course, it leads to a critical contradiction with the original assumption. It leads to violation of unitarity. And so it leads to the statement that what we started with, the quantum mechanical theory of gravity, is not in fact quantum mechanical. And so that's really part of the underlying severe tension here that we need to overcome in understanding quantum gravity as applied to black holes. In thinking about quantum gravity, we should try to go after some general organizational principles. And at least that's one approach to it. And one really basic organizational principle in any quantum system, whether it's quantum gravity or something else, is how to think about subsystems. And so applied to black holes, is a black hole a quantum subsystem? Can we think of taking, say, the universe containing a black hole and dividing that in some mathematically precise way into an environment subsystem and a black hole subsystem? So that's really a very basic structural question that one can ask. And that leads to the more general question in gravity, how do you think about subsystems to begin with? And I want to emphasize that is a rather subtle question. I think some of you appreciate that. That's a quite subtle question. We have, of course, a standard way of thinking about subsystems in finite quantum systems. You just take products of Hilbert spaces. In quantum field theory, it's a little more complicated. You work with the algebras, but in gravity, it's even more complicated. So that's a question that's been explored some in work with Donnelly, and then subsequent work by myself, and in the black hole context, also with Sean Weinberg. And just to emphasize how important that question is, say, for the problem at hand, well, essentially a negative answer to the question, is a black hole a quantum subsystem? A negative answer to that has been suggested to possibly resolve the problem of black hole information through the picture involving soft hair. That's essentially what Hawking and Hawking, Perry, and Strominger appear to have been saying, that in essence, you don't have isolated degrees of freedom in the black hole. In some sense, the information is still present in the environment and somehow in the soft hair. Now, there are counter arguments to that line of thinking, which are provided by some of the later parts of this work and another paper. So actually, I think I personally don't believe that that's the resolution to the problem. But again, that emphasizes how important it is to really carefully understand these things. Another follow-up question is, if you have subsystems, and if a black hole is a subsystem, you know, how do they evolve? And of course, you know, Hawking's approximate version of how they evolve leads to non-unitarity. But if we're going to rescue quantum mechanics, we need to understand how they can evolve in a unitary fashion. Turning that around, there's something that you might think of as a theorem, a black hole theorem. If black holes do behave as subsystems, if evolution is unitary, and if black holes disappear at the end of evolution, then there must be couplings that transfer the information out of a black hole in order to, you know, preserve that unitarity. So this is something we really need to understand. And a first goal, and that's going to be largely the subject of the talk, is to just understand all of this somewhat more sharply in a standard local quantum field theory description. Understand how to think about black holes as evolving quantum subsystems. You know, we've over the decades made a large number of very general statements about how this works, and we draw pictures and so on. But it's interesting that there isn't or hasn't been, you know, a full precise understanding of, say, the evolving quantum state of a black hole. Even in the local quantum field theory approximation, where you're neglecting some of the important effects of quantum gravity. So it's nice to see kind of a more explicit description of how that all works. And again, to emphasize, you know, if you have the local quantum field theory description, ultimately that is, according to Hawking's arguments, going to lead to the original problem. So this black hole theorem implies that there must be some modifications to that. And part of the question then is, can we understand those modifications as, say, a small correction to the local quantum field theory picture, or maybe it's a big correction? I think some people here might say, actually, the corrections are big. And but at least a good starting point is to understand if you can save quantum mechanics with small corrections. And that's a line of argument that I've pursued some in this paper and a number of preceding references, and an overview is given in this 2019 paper. And I'll say a few more words about that perspective at the end. So at the same time as warming up to this set of questions, how do we restore unitarity, we can just a little more carefully address some longstanding questions about the Hawking process itself. Where is Hawking radiation produced? Is it produced, you know, down in some very short distance region near the horizon or not? Is there a Trans-Planckian problem related to that? And how do we treat interacting theories? Of course, the standard deviation or derivations of Hawking radiation involve tracing modes back to the vicinity of the horizon, which works perfectly well in a free theory, but in an interacting theory, that's somewhat more challenging. So we'd like to improve on our understanding of, you know, just how to explicitly treat Hawking radiation. Okay. So this talk, like I've been saying, is a talk that will be confined largely to the standard local quantum field theory description. But an important question, which we could discuss another time and has been discussed elsewhere, is how the standard description is modified. And again, I want to emphasize understanding the modifications to this standard picture is likely to be a key guide towards the deeper principles of quantum gravity. And the analogy I keep coming back to personally is that this problem is like understanding the correct physics of the atom. And by the time we did that, we really had unveiled a lot of what quantum mechanics means. And so, you know, in my view, the black hole, quantum black holes are playing a similar role for quantum gravity. Okay, so that being said, we're largely focusing on the local quantum field theory description. So how do we describe the evolving quantum state of a black hole in that context? And so just to start out, we'll consider, say, the static spherically symmetric black holes, like Schwarzschild, say, in four or higher dimensions. And so that metric has the standard form that everyone here, I'm sure, knows and loves. written in standard Schwarzschild coordinates. I want to emphasize, though, that this discussion will generalize also to two-dimensional black holes, just with a slightly different slightly different function here entering the metric coefficients. Namely, if we have a function with this exponential fall off as a function of R, we can describe also the two-dimensional black holes that are relevant in dilaton gravity, for example, that arise in the so-called CGHS model. And so we can treat everything in terms of a metric of this form. And I'll focus more on those towards the end because that gives a particularly simple example of the evolving quantum state. Now, of course, as everyone knows, these coordinates are only, these coordinates become singular at the horizon. And so you can't extend smoothly across the horizon in these coordinates. But we go over to Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates to avoid that. So I'll call the Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates x plus, and of course r still the radius. And here is an Eddington-Finkelstein diagram. So lines of constant x plus correspond to incoming null rays. And then of course the other coordinate is just the good old radius. And capital R represents the location of the event horizon. Now, of course, this geometry is a good, classical geometry, as everyone knows. The question is, how relevant is it for physical quantum black holes, which are evaporating? But the nice thing about the evaporation is it's extremely slow, and you can quantify that. You can ask, how fast is this, radius of the black hole changing with time. And it's, of course, a very, very slow rate for large black holes. It's down by basically a power of the entropy. And so even for a physical quantum black hole, we can, to a very good approximation, use this kind of stationary picture of the black hole to describe what's going on. Okay, so in that context, how do we describe the evolving quantum state? And a standard way of doing that, if you think about, say, cosmology or other contexts for quantum field theory in a background, is to pick some kind of time slicing through your geometry. So we can, we just choose some set of slices. We can parameterize those slices by giving these functions, which tell us, what are slices of constant time. And then, of course, we need parameters along those slices, which I'll call capital Xi. And, this has been done, at least at some level, in black hole space times. There's some earlier examples. And then with such a choice of slices, we can decompose the metric in a different fashion in the standard ADM form in terms of the lapse, the shift, and the spatial metric, and treat those variables as the, essentially the dynamical variables to describe something closer to a time evolution than the usual four-dimensional picture. Now, in choosing these slices, one useful thing to do is to exploit the symmetries that are present. And so, of course, the obvious one is the rotational symmetry. So it makes most sense to choose slices that respect that. And so we just have these functions giving us the time slices and the radial coordinate along those slices not be a function of the angles. And, the angles are separately spatial coordinates. But also it's useful to respect the time translation symmetry or the approximate time translation symmetry. And we do that by choosing a set of slices where T is just linearly related to X plus. The time translation symmetry just corresponds to translations in X plus. So these are specified just by a single function of R, and I'll call such a slicing a stationary slicing. And then we may or may not want to choose our spatial coordinates along these slices also to be independent of time. In some cases, it's useful actually not to do that, but in other cases, we will do that. Now, when one considers these slices, so again, this is the basic equation for such a time slice, there are different classes of such slicing. So the traditional kind of slicing based on the Schwarzschild coordinates that looks like this and doesn't go inside the horizon is given if we take this slice function to be the tortoise coordinate or the Reggie Wheeler coordinate as a function of R. But, as alluded to, there are other choices. One nice choice, is to keep your slices away from the singularity. So have the slices go off and avoid the singularity. And you can achieve that by taking the slicing function to go to minus infinity, say at some finite radius, maybe a tenth of the black hole radius or something like that. Another kind of slices is that you might consider are those that are naturally adapted to, say, the observations of infalling observers. I call those natural slices. And a particularly mathematically simple choice is just to take, what I call straight slices, where the slice function is just the radial coordinate. And that gives a picture that looks like this. One thing to emphasize, these latter two choices of slices, at least in the four-dimensional case, are not good Cauchy slices for the geometry. And the reason for that is, of course, anything that falls in back here, say along a null ray, will go in and hit R equals zero. So unless you add some extra degrees of freedom at R equals zero, they're not captured by the quantum state on such a slice. But on the other hand, these nice slices can serve as Cauchy slices for the space-time in four dimensions and higher. And so that's one reason why it's important to consider those. But if we think about the two-dimensional case, which we also generalize to, then you can actually use the straight or the natural slices to give Cauchy slices for the space-time, because really in the two-dimensional case, the space-time extends past what we've called R equals zero to R equals minus infinity. This diagram keeps going and you can just follow the slices on out. So that's one difference between the two and higher dimensional case. Okay, now once we have chosen our spatial coordinates, our time slices, we've got a choice of spatial coordinates as well, which I alluded to. And those are important in determining what the lapse and shift are. So here's a general picture of a slicing through a geometry. And let's define a vector C, which is the vector that connects points at the same spatial coordinate, whatever we've chosen to be the spatial coordinate, on different time slices, okay? And so C determines the lapse and the shift. And that's because, of course, we project that into the normal to get the lapse. And if you project it into the orthogonal or the direction parallel to the slice, then you get the components of the shift. So this choice of the spatial coordinate along the slices is also important for determining the evolution. When you write down the Hamiltonian in the ADM variables, it looks like this. Let's think about the Hamiltonian of a free scalar field. And then here we have the canonical momentum, canonically conjugate momentum, of course, the scalar field. And we end up with an expression that looks like this. It depends on the actual values of the lapse and the shift. So if we choose different spatial coordinatizations, we'll change the form of the shift and will change the form of the Hamiltonian. So you also see that explicitly when you notice that you can rewrite the Hamiltonian in terms of the stress tensor, basically dotted into the normal and into this vector that connects points at the same value of x. Okay, so in any case, that's how to write down the Hamiltonian for whatever choice you make. And then the evolving quantum state in a Schrodinger-like picture is given by the exponential of the Hamiltonian. depending on those choices. Just to emphasize how different choices can lead to different descriptions of the evolution, what I call different pictures, let's think about two cases in two dimensions. We have two-dimensional flat space, and we think about just a right-moving scalar, a scalar that's a function only of x minus, where, of course, x plus or minus or t plus or minus x. If we had chosen ordinary time and ordinary x as the coordinates, we'd just have the standard form for the Hamiltonian from this. No big surprise there. But of course, if we'd chosen a different coordinate along the slices, say the coordinate x minus, then we have actually a vanishing Hamiltonian. So that really emphasizes the dependence of the Hamiltonian on this choice of also the spatial coordinate or the coordinate along the slice. And the reason that the Hamiltonian vanishes in this case is that, of course, if you identify points at the same x minus, well, this field is not changing if you follow lines of constant x minus. So these are both different descriptions of the same dynamics, which correspond to different pictures, somewhat analogous to the connection between Heisenberg and Schrodinger pictures, and arise from these different, like I said, choices of the not only the slicing, but of the coordinates along the slice. Again, feel free to ask questions if any arise during the talk. Okay.
Allow me just one super, maybe it's completely stupid, silly, about your example. I understand that one of the two modes doesn't change along the null lay, but what about the other? I mean, I just...
Missing
a piece here. Sorry, maybe a stupid question.
No, it's not. So what I've done here, I sort of went past a bunch of stuff pretty fast. But if we just took a scalar field in two dimensions, it of course could have left and right movers.
Yeah.
Here I'm talking about the right movers. So the Hamiltonian, the right moving part of the Hamiltonian vanishes.
Yeah. Sure.
But the left moving part of the Hamiltonian will be non-vanishing even in this case. But the point is that the Hamiltonian takes a different form for the different choices of spatial coordinate along the slice, more precisely.
Okay, sure, I get it.
Yeah, okay. Other questions? Okay. So sometimes it's useful to take a more general such spatial coordinate along the slices, like I was talking about in the black hole background, something that essentially is time dependent. And for example, that's a useful thing when we talk about the so-called nice slice evolution. You can see a sort of freezing of the internal state with certain choices of like this of the internal coordinates along the slices. But for other purposes, it's useful to use the just a stationary choice of the coordinates like I described. And so just to give a quick example, if you take the coordinate along the slices just to be given by R, that's the simplest possibility, then you can re-express the Schwarzschild metric in terms of the lapse and the shift with very simple formulas for the lapse and shift, which I've just given here in terms of this slicing function, whatever it is, that gives the shape of the slices, and the function f, which is the basic metric coefficient. So those are just formulas to file away, which we're going to use shortly. Okay, so now what about quantization? We've chosen our slices and our spatial coordinates, and then what we do is we take the field and its canonically conjugate momenta, and expand those in a basis of solutions. So we can think about these giving a basis in terms of, functions on phase space. And of course, we need a way of separating that basis into the so-called positive frequency, or at least a choice of what we call positive frequency and negative frequency solutions. We separate the basis by giving one way of stating it is giving a complex structure on the space. And you know, of course, we typically want to choose the basis elements to be orthogonal in the standard inner product or unity, so an orthonormal basis in this usual fashion. And then once we do that, we have the standard description of the ladder operators and their commutation relations, so standard commutators between ladder operators. And we can, of course, write down the states by starting with a vacuum that's annihilated by the basic annihilation operators, and then building up a Fox-based construction by acting with creation operators. And the point one of the points I want to make is that when we do this based on one of these regular slicings that cross across the horizon, it leads to a perfectly regular description of the evolving quantum state, including near the horizon. It leads to a regular description of the production of Hawking radiation, not in some, you know, trans-Planckian region down near the horizon or Planck size region, but in an atmosphere region of size of order the Schwarzschild radius. And also we end up with a nice decomposition in this approximation into subsystems that is just like the standard decomposition in local quantum field theory. So I'll exhibit some of that in an explicit example just shortly, but let me just mention that, you know, people have thought about Schrodinger quantization before in a curved background. Sometimes there are problems with that in time-dependent backgrounds, and there's been, you know, a thread of discussion in the literature about that. But at least here, say when you think about Schwarzschild, you're basically working with a time-independent problem. Although we could make it look time dependent just as well by choosing different pictures, different choices of coordinates, and we should be able to handle that as well. But for our purposes, it's basically a stationary problem, and so we don't run into some of these issues that have been raised, which we might want to rethink sort of moving forward as well. Okay, so we're describing, like I said, the evolving quantum state in a Schrodinger-like picture, or as I've argued, there can be different, essentially, pictures. So let me exhibit all this in a in the two-dimensional case where it actually is most simple. The higher than two-dimensional case is more technically complicated. Because as everyone I'm sure knows, you have, you know, these effective potentials outside the black hole, you have both reflection and transmission, it just makes everything messier. So it's simpler just to think about the two-dimensional case to understand the basics. So again, but this is a case we're working out with, again, a UCSB student, Julie Perkins, who I think is actually attending the talk here. But in two dimensions, we just start out with a two-dimensional metric. And as I've said, we can express that just as well in Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. And it's also useful to express it in terms of coordinates x plus and x minus, where x minus is, well, this is the nicest way of seeing what x minus is. It's the right moving coordinate where you use as a spatial coordinate the tortoise coordinate. So x minus is a coordinate, a chiral coordinate that goes to infinity as you approach the horizon. And then of course you have to introduce a coordinate to parameterize the region inside the horizon, which is x hat minus, which is analogously defined, okay? So those are some of the different coordinate choices. And a nice thing is that in the case of these dilaton gravity black holes, where the metric coefficient just has this exponential form, or I'll write it in terms of the radius, the Schwarzschild radius, basically, which is essentially the log of the mass, I'll write it as this, we have particularly nice relations between those coordinates, which will turn out to be quite useful. So I'm going to focus just on the right movers, the outgoing modes, because the ingoing modes aren't contributing to the Hawking radiation. We're going to focus on the Hawking radiation. And if I want to give a description of the evolving quantum state, as I've already indicated, that depends on some choices. We need to choose a set of slices, coordinates along the slices, and modes. We, of course, ultimately expect that the physics is independent of those choices. And that's something we might try to check at a later stage. So for slices, let's just use the example of the so-called straight slices. So here's a picture of, again, the straight slices in the Eddington-Finkelstein diagram, where now I'm thinking about, say, some infalling matter producing a two-dimensional black hole. So we really only have the Schwarzschild-like solution up in this region. And we can also describe the time-dependent solution that produces that from vacuum. And the relationship, when you use this kind of slicing between the radial coordinate and your time coordinate along the slices, that describes the slices, and these x minus and x hat minus coordinates, is this simple relationship, which we'll use a little bit as we go on. So the next thing is the choice of spatial coordinates or some coordinates along the slices. They may not be strictly spatial coordinates. So like I said, if you choose something like a coordinate x minus for the coordinate along the slices, then the Hamiltonian is going to vanish analogously to the flat space case. But instead, let's, for our purposes, choose as the coordinate along the slices, simply the coordinate r. And then finally, describing the Schrodinger quantization, one needs a choice of modes, and there are different possibilities here too. The obvious thing to do once you've chosen your spatial coordinate is just take plane waves in that spatial coordinate at any time, so e to the ikr. But one could choose different modes. For example, you could take the so-called energy eigenmodes, which are e to the minus I omega x minus or x hat minus. You could use those at a given time, re-express x minus in terms of r, and use those as a basis of modes to expand in. Of course, these are the modes that are used in the usual treatments of Hawking radiation, the modes that you basically trace back and become singular near the horizon. Those are quite useful, but they do have that feature of being, giving a basis that's ill-behaved at the horizon. So let's first focus on the evolution for the regular modes. So we expand the field in terms of the mode functions and coefficients, which are the ladder operators. And again, to emphasize the field operator, we think of as being time independent because we're working in a Schrodinger-like picture as opposed to a Heisenberg picture. And then we can just find the Hamiltonian from the ADM form that I had before and from the form for the lapse and the shift that I showed you. You just plug it in and you get an expression that looks like this. Or expanding out in annihilation and creation operators, you'll of course have bilinears in those. And here the function that enters, just with a little bit of work, turns out to be a quite simple function. It's just f over 2 minus f, in the case of the two-dimensional black hole, is just the tan. Simple as can be. So when you plug in the expansion of the field, you find that these coefficients of the terms that describe either particle creation or particle propagation, these coefficients are just Fourier transforms of the tanh. So specifically, you can begin with, say, the vacuum 0R, nice regular vacuum, and you can just evolve it. You could have started with some other time-dependent initial state, but let's just think about evolving the initial vacuum near the horizon, or everywhere for that matter, and you can evolve it. And specifically, again, these coefficients B, since they multiply products of creation operators, are the relevant terms for describing the particle production that is, basically production of Hawking radiation. So already from this description, we see a number of aspects of the state. We see, first of all, that the production takes place, not in some transplanckian region down near the horizon or something like this, We see quite explicitly that the particle production is governed by this thing that's the Fourier transform of the tanh. The tanh, you know, has the good old familiar behavior where it's falling off, you know, not really rapidly, but on scales of order one. By the way, the relevant scale in the two-dimensional case, sort of the scale setting the thickness of the atmosphere, is a dimensionful scale that we've set equal to one in defining the black hole solution. And so the analog in higher dimensions would be just, you know, fall off with scales of order the event horizon size. In the two-dimensional case, you know, we've got that e to the minus r fall off, and that is coming from one of the parameters in the Lagrangian. But in any case, we have, but that's not the Planck scale, is the point. It's a much longer scale. So we have, you know, something that's falling off to these asymptotic values, one and minus one, you know, in that wider region. And that's where the production is taking place. You also see quite explicitly from computing the Fourier transform, which is easy, that you have a thermal spectrum. You have fall off in the production of high energy modes that's exponential with what is the correct temperature for the two-dimensional case. And related to the fact that you are producing modes in the atmosphere and only effectively producing modes that are low energy, there's no really relevant trans-Planckian physics going on here. At short scales, you're just dealing with basically the vacuum. And so all of those are sort of, you know, nice features one can see. Of course, the drawback with such a description is that the evolution in this way of describing it is kind of complicated because these coefficients are complicated and you have both, you know, particle production going on and then it evolves with this, you know, not entirely simple evolution that, you know, comes from these, you know, slightly complicated functions, not too complicated. So can we make contact with a more familiar description? And we can, and that's through using these singular modes, the singular basis, which those are the energy eigenmodes. So let's give an alternate description, which looks simpler in terms of the energy eigenmode. So we could have just as well expanded the field in terms of the energy eigenmodes. Now we'll call the coefficients B and B hat, depending on whether you're talking about modes inside the horizon in the case of B hat or outside the horizon in the case of B. And if you expand in modes that are energy eigenmodes, no surprise, you've diagonalized the Hamiltonian. Okay, so you don't have, in that way of looking at it, particle creation. You just have particle propagation with the diagonal Hamiltonian. And of course, you see that you have a nice reflection of statements that are commonly made. You have positive frequency modes outside the horizon, but the modes that are inside the horizon in this description have a negative energy. And that kind of thing is, you know, often stated colloquially. We think of the modes inside the horizon as having negative energy. So if the evolution is so simple, how do we see Hawking production? Well, if we start out with an initial state, which is the vacuum that's regular at the horizon, that is very different from the vacuum for the B and B hat modes, which I'll call zero hat zero, and differs by this, you know, Bogle-Yubov transformation, which basically looks like it's creating an infinite number of particles on top of the B hat and B vacuum. And I, in fact, write that this, I don't write an equality here because, in fact, they don't even, this state and this state, at least if you're careful about it, don't even live in the same spaces because of the sort of infinite number of particles and their infinite entanglement down near the horizon. That's related to the type three property of von Neumann algebras associated with field theory. Essentially is telling us that this vacuum doesn't live in a product Hilbert space of the modes inside and outside the horizon. Specifically, when you look at this Bogle-Yubov transformation, which I'm not giving you, if you look at it for modes down near the horizon, you have kind of a familiar structure, which I'm sure many have seen, where you have the correlated modes, if you think about modes that are occupation number eigenstates, you have correlated modes both out inside in the Hadid case and outside the horizon with this basic thermal factor. Of course, to write this expression, this expression isn't literally true. To write this expression, you have to have a way of localizing the modes. So you're talking about modes down near the horizon. So really, you should work in terms of a localized wave packet basis, not in terms of the plane wave modes, which are spread everywhere. So this is even, a stronger, similar sign, so to speak, when I write the second form of the expression. Okay, but we see the basic features that we're familiar with, paired excitations down near the horizon in this basis, which then we can think of as evolving away from the horizon and becoming the real Hawking particles. In fact, it's a nice fact that as you move away from the horizon, the creation operators in this basis turn out to be nicely identified with the creation operators in the regular basis, so the excitations are identified. So let me explain a little bit more carefully how that works. So here was our basic relationship between the coordinates, the time coordinate in this straight slicing, the radial coordinate, and these chiral coordinates, x minus and x hat minus. We also can introduce what is the two-dimensional analog of the crustal coordinate, capital X minus, which then enters into the expression like that. And so first of all, if we look at this relation for r very near the horizon, of course, we know the expansion of the cinch. And so we get a linear relation between the coordinate along the slice and the crustal coordinate. And so that tells us that the coordinate along the slice the vacuum in the R modes is essentially the same as the vacuum that you would form if you expanded in terms of the X minus modes, at least for purposes of describing the state down near the horizon. And so that has this paired structure. If you re-express it in terms of the modes that come from the other chiral coordinate, the energy eigenmodes, so that's just restating what we've already said, but also including the version of the vacuum written in terms of the crustal coordinate. But then when you go far from the horizon, this expression then gives us actually a linear relationship between the radial coordinate along the slice and the coordinate x minus. And that also happens inside the horizon as well, but let's focus on the region outside the horizon. So because of that linear relationship, that tells us that if you're far from the horizon, again, you have to think in terms of wave packets, a creation operator in the R basis or in the, for e to the IKR modes is the same as a creation operator for e to the IKX minus modes, okay? So in other words, the structure of the regular vacuum when you're far from the horizon is it looks just like this vacuum in the energy eigenbasis. Modes are identified, again, just to restate. Okay, so that gives us finally a full picture of the evolution, which looks something like this. So say we start out with the vacuum, we have some infalling matter, and then we'll have some if we have this kind of situation, some state which depends on that formation, okay? And so you'll end up with some transitional radiation going out and produced from the time-dependent formation. But the important thing is that down near the horizon, we have modes that are behaving like they're in the regular vacuum, which can be re-expressed in the energy eigenbasis in the familiar form. And as you evolve forward in time, as you evolve forward in time, those modes turn into just, the standard description of outgoing Hawking modes, but we can give a description of that in a fully regular basis. And so we do get the familiar form for the outgoing Hawking state with entanglement between the outgoing excitations and the internal excitations. And of course, if you take the trace over the internal excitations, you form a density matrix with a growing entropy, a growing von Neumann entropy with the growth linear in time. So there isn't a huge amount of news here, but we've given a very explicit and nice description of the evolving quantum state. And I've only given that in two dimensions, but it's a description that generalizes to higher dimensions. Again, you know, you just have to work a little bit harder to deal with the various detailed complications of higher dimensions, like the reflection, transmission, et cetera. That's work in progress. Okay, so we have confirmed in a nice way our expectations for how Hawking radiation works in a nice explicit way. There are no big surprises, but we do have greater confidence in at least that description of the picture. We have an explicit way of sort of exhibiting the decomposition in the connection with how we think about subsystems in local quantum field theory, decomposition into a subsystem associated with the black hole in the environment, something like a product of Hilbert spaces, but not quite exactly because of the usual story of local quantum field theory in type three. We've got a decomposition of the Hamiltonian into, we can write it as a part that evolves the modes inside the black hole, a part that evolves the modes in the environment, and an interaction part, which we might associate with the interface between them. We have, within that context, local evolution of the two subsystems, of course, with the interactions between them. And also, all of this perfectly well is going to extend if we include interactions in the Hamiltonian. That's just a simple extension of the basic framework. Again, no surprises, but by reinforcing the standard understanding, it also sharpens the underlying problem. And so let's go back and ask in the last few minutes, this is the description a la Hawking, done in a, just a more explicit fashion as an evolving quantum state, but how is the more complete quantum evolution unitary? And when you start with this picture, you can imagine two obvious possibilities. One is that there's, like I alluded to, some possible breakdown of this structure where you have separate subsystems of the bigger quantum system. The first question is there a breakdown of that structure just within Einstein gravity? Nothing fancy, just Einstein gravity. And that is essentially the kind of claim that's been made in the soft hair story, that again, because of soft hair, maybe the information never really is in the black hole. It's out in the soft modes of the gravitational field outside the horizon, et cetera. And so of course, Hawking, Perry, and Strominger have given arguments along those lines. Okay, so we can take this story one step further and add the gravitational dressing. Essentially, that's what's going to include the soft hair. The story of subsystems in the gravitational context, as I told you in the introduction, is more complicated, and you can read those references. But the bottom line is that when you get to further into that story, there is at least perturbatively significant evidence, it seems, that you do have a sense in which you have subsystems in gravity, although not precisely with the same structure as in quantum field theory. And so that seems to, in my mind, be a pretty strong counterargument to this notion that just in quantization of standard Einstein gravity, you can't isolate the information inside the black hole. In essence, there can apparently be a large number of states inside the black hole with an indistinguishable dressing outside. Okay, so that kind of breakdown of subsystem structure, or a breakdown of subsystem structure in that context, doesn't appear to me to be the answer. Another possibility is maybe there are new quantum gravity effects that lead to a breakdown of the subsystem structure, either beyond Einstein GR or some non-perturbative effects. Well, maybe, but if we're going to think about new effects, it seems at least as plausible that those new effects explore a second alternative, that there's just a modification of the evolution. And so we can try to parameterize what that modification would look like. If we do have something that looks like an approximate subsystem structure with a black hole in the environment, and information needs to transfer from one to the other. The simplest way of achieving that is by having some modification to the Hamiltonian, where we have operators that act on the black hole state connected with operators that act on the environment. And so we can just expand the general kind of bilinear of that form with some coefficients just as a starting point to parameterize evolution that would communicate information from the black hole to the environment. Taking that one step further, we would think about possibly constraining what these coefficients could be and using other general principles to determine their structure. And so one obvious thing to consider is, or at least to ask, is can these corrections to evolution be small in some appropriate sense? And there are arguments that they can, in some appropriate sense, be small and yet achieve what we need, which is unitarity of the ultimate evolution. Now, a specific form for those couplings that I've considered, and this is based on partly on Gedanken experiments involving black hole mining and on also the universality of gravity, is that these couplings actually aren't to just arbitrary operators which would produce arbitrary particles in the atmosphere of a black hole. But say the coupling is just to something like the stress tensor. It has a universal nature in terms of its action on the atmosphere of the black hole, on the degrees of freedom outside the black hole. And then some operators that couple to that that act on the black hole state. So specifically, there's been some exploration of this kind of form of the information transferring interactions. And that's discussed more in, for example, this sort of review. And we could say more about that later. But in any case, that is a natural avenue to pursue in the search for a unitary description of evolution. I think many also know that there has been a lot of discussion recently of replica wormholes, potentially in this way of thinking about things, the evolving quantum state. There's a connection there, if that's your what you believe is the correct picture. Instead of having, having an explicit description of the modifications to evolution that look like this, if wormholes do lead to important effects, you can summarize those in terms of operators acting on the evolving quantum state. And this goes back to discussions of the effects of space-time wormholes from what the 80s or something like that. So one could also explore that avenue. The final thing I want to say is that if the story is some new kind of interactions, those interactions, of course, aren't just modifying evolution down in the center of the black hole, but they have to reach out to radii of order, the event horizon size. And that, of course, raises the possibility of observational effects, either via gravitational wave observation with LIGO, or electromagnetic observation with the Event Horizon Telescope. And that's also a line of questioning that I've explored some in these other references, which I'll just point you to since I am essentially out of time. So I'll go ahead and stop there and see if there are any questions.
Thanks, Steve, for this very nice talk.
Thank you.
Okay, so are there questions first from students? Okay, for now I don't see questions from students. So Carlo has a question.
Yeah, Steve, great. I mean, I love this presentation. It makes me happy. In particular, because I would have liked to do something like that, and you're very good in this thing. So it's completely convincing. Let me my question is, let me put it this way: your talk had a sort of three parts, a central one which was 9/10 of the talks, which was technical and showing some of what happens according to the quantum field theory on which we find, which we trust up to.
Well, trust or don't trust in the end, but trust.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, what seemed to imply what we have seen so far about the universe or quantum theory, and this is a very convincing story, the one you give. I mean, I follow carefully. I mean, I was thinking yes, fantastic. So it's very convincing story, and then. You had a comment at the beginning and a comment at the end. The comment at the end, it's possible directions for addressing the problem, which you mentioned also some ideas of yours, which I know independently. And the comment at the beginning was that there is a problem, okay? Now, my question is about there is a problem because I don't see this problem. So I would like, if we can, to take a minute to at the light of what you're saying, and it precisely because what you're saying, to ask where the hell is the problem? I can't see it. I know about the Planck, the page curve. I know all the story, but I still don't see the problem for the following reason. Let me just say it, and then go precisely to the question. Can you put the initial slide where you have the Penrose diagram of the
yeah? I've got to figure out how to black hole. Well, I wish I were more there. Okay, I paged back pretty quickly.
Yeah, this one.
I guess, one. Yeah, this perfect. One. Yeah. Sorry, that one.
Yeah, okay. This one. So if this is a evaporating black hole, now everything you have done is of course. How would I say, so far without quantum gravity, right? The technical part. So we have a given space-time and the given space-time is essentially assumed to be the one given by classical general relativity. So the entire story that you give, obviously, I mean, you would agree with me, is supposed to go wrong because of quantum gravity. We hope it to go wrong because of quantum gravity somewhere. Quantum gravity should come in. Now, if you look at that picture and you follow the horizon, at some point the horizon becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. Outside it, outside this horizon, the curvature goes 1/r³. So when the horizon is small, the curvature is Planckian outside the horizon. Not when it's macroscopic, but this has become smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. At some point, it becomes Planckian. So therefore, outside the horizon, we are in a Planckian region. So quantum gravity comes in, we expect quantum gravity, as far as we know, as far as we expect. We expect quantum gravity to become important near the singularity, somehow when the curvature become Planck or whatever, and outside the horizon before the end of the evaporation, which means that the whatever is past that region is totally unreliable. And in particular, the thing which is totally unreliable is that there is an event horizon. The fact, of course, there is an horizon, right? There's a trapping horizon. There's a horizon that you have described, which is very good.
Yeah, but our description breaks down when, I agree, when curvatures go Planckian, our description clearly breaks down.
Right, exactly. So therefore, this picture that, this diagram that you show, it's completely unreliable because it assumes that when it's small, the black hole just pops out of existence.
Yeah.
And it makes an assumption about quantum gravity here. Right, because this is a quantum gravity phenomenon.
Yeah. Now, so if there is no event,
let me sharp it up. If there is a quantum gravity effect there, that simply, I mean, you've been working on long time ago. Then I don't see any problem at all, unless you take the page story and you believe that the number of states inside diminish in number when the horizon shrinks, which your result is saying that is not the case. So your result is saying, the way I read your result is, look, don't believe the page story. It's not true. Then when the throat is small, the number of state inside is small, and therefore there is no problem whatsoever for not having an event horizon, having a trapping horizon or a dynamical horizon, a long living remnant, not living infinite, and unitarity with everything you've said without anything changing until the end of the black hole evaporation. This is okay. A picture we have from low quantum gravity. I don't understand why, I'm not saying this is the right picture. Of course, we don't know quantum gravity, but where is the problem?
Okay, so let me try to phrase it in terms of this other way ahead of phrasing it. And this really summarizes a longer discussion, which it might be challenging to have fully now, but let me at least try to give an overview of the next layer of that discussion. So first, the statement, if black holes do behave as subsystems, and if they do behave as subsystems, and at least the Hawking process gives an approximately correct description, then they build up entanglement with their environment. They have missing information. And if they then disappear, if those subsystems disappear at the end of evolution, and evolution is unitary, obviously we have a contradiction unless that information or entanglement can transfer out of the subsystem before it disappears. Okay, so far so good. Okay, now we get into some more of the details about, you know, how that information transfers out, how rapidly it needs to transfer out, and that depends on how much information there is. So first, the amount of information that you build up, say in the first half of the black hole evaporation, is something comparable to the Bekenstein-Hawking value. Right. Okay, so there's that much information that has to come out, so to speak.
Right.
And then when you look at bounds on how that comes out, for example, it's M, of course, M squared is the amount of information, but yeah, if you wait until very late in the evaporation and then say it has to come out, you don't have a lot of energy left. Right. And so you ask how long it takes and you end up with something that lasts for a long time. And so it behaves like a black hole remnant. Right. And in that situation, there are other arguments, which, you know, we would have to re-give, but that kind of spectrum for objects in the universe is extremely problematic because in other contexts, it leads to basically infinite or unbounded production of these objects.
The argument for which this
there's a longer discussion there, but I think
20 years ago, but it, you cannot base on a specific model to make the statement that there is a problem because a certain particular solution didn't work 20 years ago. I mean, there are white hole stabilized by quantum gravity models in which are perfectly clear. They don't form by themselves. There's no infinite production, nothing like that. They live for a long time, N4, sufficient to bring the information out, which might be discussed. And maybe that right model is the wrong model. But the point is that the physics that we know does not lead to a problem so far. It might lead to a problem with discussing these models.
Lee wants to add something that is probably...
Let me quickly respond to that last comment of Carlo's and then let's take Lee's question. So it's true that we looked at that problem of infinite production in certain specific contexts, but I think there's a fair amount of evidence in general arguments that it's reflective of a more general problem. And the underlying problem is if you have a thing with a certain mass, say, or spectrum of masses, and you have a really large number of internal states, that those things will have production which grows with that number of internal states. And that number of internal states is what kills you. So that's general effective field theory reasoning. Anyway, we could debate whether it's valid, but that's the essence of the argument, that there's a more general statement there. And, you know, maybe there's some way around it, but from what I've seen, I don't think so. Anyway, Lee, I think, has a question.
I'm afraid it's just a continuation of the same argument. We looked with Sabina Hassenfelder in great detail at your effective field theory arguments, and they're not valid. The assumptions of effective field theory and the use of effective field theory in your arguments about remnants are not right. They're just not correct. And now is not the time to discuss it, but we went over in great detail and have a paper about it. Furthermore, I have to agree with Carl. Carl never said the last point of his argument. If you can go back to the previous diagram. Our whole point is that diagram does not exist in nature. That's a paradoxical diagram that Hawking constructed based on a wrong assumption or several wrong assumptions that there is a physical regime near the end. Now you can't see where I'm pointing, but near the end of the singularity, where the singularity meets the horizon. And that point is not there in nature. If you really follow carefully the evolution, the real space-time diagram looks very different from that. And generations of people have somehow tripped over. We know something is wrong with Hawking's argument, but what's wrong with Hawking's argument is the assumptions of that diagram.
Well, okay, so first of all, I was not basing a lot on this diagram except to say, you know, that's how it's conventionally been looked at, you know, over time. So, you know, my arguments are not necessarily based on this diagram. What I'm thinking about is just describing the evolving quantum state of a black hole in interaction with its environment.
Right. So we're two places, if I may, where we believe you make incorrect assumptions are assuming that there's a relationship between the area of a black hole and the number of states of the Hilbert space that describes the interior. The assumption of that assumption, which we can call the strong Bekenstein bound, seems wrong, and there are a number of arguments that it's wrong. What's correct is the weak Bekenstein bound, which says there's a bound related to the area of the horizon of the information transferred through that surface. That weak Bekenstein bound does not lead to any worry about there being a problem with a big, something like a bag of gold, a Hilbert space deep in the interior, even when there's a small mass of the total.
Okay, well, I sense this is a longer discussion, which may be hard to resolve, but let me say the following. There's another, I think, essentially independent argument for the number of internal quantum states that we have to deal with in this context. It's independent of just calculating the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And it's precisely to look at this evolution that I've just described. I won't try to scroll to the relevant slide, but just look at the evolution that I've described in the regime where it's valid, where we think quantum gravity gives you small corrections, okay? And ask how much entropy of entanglement do we build up between the external excitations and the black hole internal state? Okay. That's an independent calculation. And we can ask, what is that value? And that comes out to be of order the Bekenstein-Hawking value. Let's not worry about factors of order unity.
Good. And why is that a problem? If you're allowed to have
fine
space. Because that quantifies the amount of information that is, yes, so to speak, missing in the black hole interior.
But it's not
missing. We agree here. We completely agree here.
You stated where it is. It's in the black hole interior.
Yeah.
And it has been modeled and can be discussed. And we agree with you, it's physically there. We just don't see why that leads to a contradiction with anything.
Okay, so that's a large number of black hole internal states, which is of order the Bekenstein-Hawking value. So, but it's an independent argument, okay? But then the question is, if you want, you know, if that's in, those states are entangled with the outgoing Hawking radiation, and we want to save unitarity in the end, that information has to somehow transfer back out. And the question is, how?
Okay.
It doesn't have to transfer back out. It might transfer back out. And then there are proposed mechanisms to do that, which do take a long time. It don't seem to be controversial. Where it might never come back, and there might be another region of space-time, which doesn't mean unitarity of quantum mechanics is broken down. Just means that an assumption about the topology of space-time is broken down.
Okay, so yeah, so from the perspective of evolution in our asymptotic region, it's true. I said it has to transfer back out, but an alternative is that from the perspective of the evolution in our asymptotic region, it could be left behind in some kind of a remnant. That's the only other alternative.
Yes. And what we'll do, the remnant could grow up and become a big universe. Just as
well,
big.
Never mind what happens inside the remnant. I'm not going to worry about that. I just want to describe the evolution in our asymptotic region.
Yes, in our asymptotic region, unitary has broken down. Why do you care about that?
Well, because, well,
we've agreed that there's more than one asymptotic region. So it makes sense that some information is there and some information isn't.
Okay, let's phrase it this way. If you want to think about other asymptotic regions and other universes branching off, you could try to give a more complete description of the full unitary evolution in, say, that multiverse or whatever it is.
Yes, granted.
Okay, so there's a longer story there, which in the end seems to lead to similar conclusions. So I don't want to go down that road too far because I just think it's a much longer discussion. But the ultimate, you know, upshot, you know, even if you have branching off baby universes, in the end, you don't have a description of the kind of non-unitary evolution that we seem to be running into with black holes. It's a different kind of animal. You know, this goes back to the discussion again of space-time wormholes, which are basically branching off of different asymptotic regions. And you know, if you systematically treat those, the kind of apparent non-unitarity you get for our universe is not the right kind for describing what happens with black holes. That's one of the basic messages.
So that's a long discussion I'd like to have sometime. But the negation of that discussion is not that the theory is dead, it's then to Carlo's kind of picture, where there's a small quantum gravity region, and then a nice classical transition where the information does get out.
You mean, okay, so, well. So
sorry,
something...
Steve, maybe reply to this, and then I would like to give space to other people who have questions.
Well, anyway, I'll just say, I think, let's phrase it this way. If there is something like a remnant scenario where the information doesn't come out, let me just add one more thing, and that is you have to address the problem also in the charged sector where you have electromagnetically charged black holes. And that's where I think the argument is even stronger, because there we have an instanton description of the production. And you can see that if there are this huge number of internal states for those objects, which you would also need if the information isn't coming out, that large number of states enhances that production in an unacceptable way. So that's another place to really sharply focus on this kind of argument. Anyway, but I guess we should move on to other questions, and this will be an ongoing discussion and debate, I'm sure.
Yeah. Hank is next.
Yeah, so I have a question regarding the interacting Hamiltonian, the delta HI.
Yeah.
That you've written down near the end there.
Yeah, let me get to it.
Mm-hmm.
I need to work on my keynote skills so I can quickly find the sidebar, but let me not attempt to do that right now. We're almost there. Okay, got it.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah, so is it right to, maybe one or two questions. So is it right to think about the integration here as over the horizon?
So I have been a little schematic in this, but what I'm doing here, you mean this integration dx?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's a spatial integration. D is the number of space-time dimensions, so it's a spatial integration. And the way I've written it here is I've separated out the part of the Hamiltonian, the operators that act on the black hole part of the Hilbert space, and I've called these operators lambda A. And so here I have in mind an integral over something like the region corresponding to the environment, you know, the atmosphere and out, further from the black hole. That's the region I have in mind integrating over in this kind of description. So I'm just describing, when I write this integral, basically the effect on the environment. And implicitly, you know, everything going on inside the black hole is contained in these operators, which, you know, evolve also according to the internal part of the Hamiltonian, et cetera.
Let's see. Because I noticed that is codimension one. So just trying to get an idea of like what it looks like, basically, like the
or look at just this version of it. So again, it's a Hamiltonian, and so a Hamiltonian in field theory involves an integral over something of codimension one in the space time, right? It's just an integral over space. So the only question is what space am I talking mm-hmm. about? And I'm talking mm-hmm. about the region of space exterior to the black hole, essentially.
I see. Okay. And the other question is, potentially there could be like, so here you've inserted point-like operators?
Local
operators, yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. So there could potentially be like higher dimensional operators, right?
What do you mean? You mean non-local or what do you mean?
Yeah, non-local operators, yeah. So like O of X. Yeah,
you could have something that's sort of smeared out. Probably expand that in a basis of things that are local. And so that's a longer discussion. But one of the things I'm doing in trying to write down something like this is trying to write down something sort of as conservative as possible, the smallest possible modification of the usual local quantum field theory evolution. And so, local quantum field theory evolution involves locality. And so let's sort of try to violate it in the least offensive way possible. And that's sort of the spirit of this. But if you're describing something that corresponds to, trying to describe the effects of emission of, big wormholes, big baby universes, if that's part of the story, mm-hmm. Then you may well have some more complicated things here that involve operators which are much more non-local on the scale of the event horizon. Mm-hmm. That's something one could also think about.
Yeah, thank you.
There is one more question by Francesca.
Thank you. I'm particularly interested in the phenomenology of all of this. So of course, I follow your work about quantum effects outside the horizon, but now listening to your talk, I was wondering about something more specific. So given the fact that the region from which the Hawking radiation is emitted, it's an extended region, have you thought about possible consequences of this, namely, if we would be able to observe the final stage of the Hawking evaporation from such an extended region, would this give a signature, a specific signature in the astrophysical signal?
I mean, so just from the conventional derivation you're asking, I guess.
Yeah, but adding the fact that it's not just a point, but it's an extended region that is emitting.
Yeah, no, because I think in the end, let me see, I'm having trouble getting back to the right picture, but in the end, the description I gave is, in one way of putting it, I think I'm almost there. Yeah, in the end, emission from a region characterized by these scales is perfectly consistent with the Hawking picture asymptotically. It gives the same answer in terms of the outgoing state at this level, but it's just giving a more careful description of, put differently, how the quantum state evolves down near the horizon, and so what, say, infalling observers would see. If you wanted to describe the state in an appropriate fashion for talking about infalling observers, well, this is a more sort of complete way of doing that.
Yeah.
I think it doesn't lead to any surprises in that regard. In some sense, I think we sort of knew this result from another perspective. There have been various discussions of this, and I think people, including myself, have said this from other perspectives as well. But one of the reasons we knew this is, the Hawking radiation comes out with a wavelength which is, it's not only the horizon size, it's something like a factor of 10 longer because of various factors of 2 and pi and stuff. Yes. And so if you're producing radiation like that, it sort of makes sense that it's produced in a region, or at least, you know, conventionally you might say it's produced in a region of comparable size, mm-hmm. sort of as a rule of thumb. But this really is sort of elaborating on that in a more careful fashion.
Okay, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Are there more questions? Ivan?
Yeah, hi. So thanks for the talk. So I was wondering, maybe it's a very naive question, maybe I didn't get it during the presentation, but could you elaborate a little bit on what you think the nature of the deformations associated to wormholes could be like the operators?
I could say a little more about that. It's a longer story. But this is also, you know, goes back to my almost prehistory. You know, we thought about emission of baby universes as a process, you know, back in the 80s, there was work by myself and Strominger and Hawking, and of course the famous work of Coleman, in trying to describe that in an effective fashion in terms of, you know, what effects that emission has on the quantum state of our universe. So very similar story. See if I can get to the relevant slide. So, you know, if you're, you know, having some emission which is, in, you know, effectively causing our quantum state to interact with the quantum state of something else, the collection of baby universes, that's going to modify our quantum state. There's going to be some operator that describes that. That operator you would expect to be local on scales of the emission, or sorry, on scales greater than the emission size. So if you have a baby universe branching off with a characteristic radius on much longer scales, you would describe that as effectively being a local operator. But then you could try to go in and carefully describe its effects on the quantum state at shorter distance scales, and then you're going to have to describe it in terms of some non-local operator. There has not been, I think, a huge amount of discussion of these things in this context, but there are things very much like this where you have emission of a string from another string in string theory. And that's not just, say, a small string, but you have actually the connection between, say, an initial, you know, string, which you're viewing as a long string, and then branching into, say, two equal length things, and you can try, or, you know, maybe you want to have some separation in scales, but you can also describe, you know, modifications involving operators like this in that kind of context as a toy model. So I think there hasn't been a huge amount of study in the context of emitting universes or baby universes, but there's at least a starting point for thinking about aspects of that.
Right. Okay, thanks. Thanks a lot.
Carlo wants to add something else?
Can you use your formalism to compute the expectation value of the flow of energy of your field through the horizon explicitly? There's a reason I'm asking this.
So what was the starting part of that question? What is the formalism?
The one you described, in which you have the field explicitly on a slice, and you actually see the formation of the Hawking radiation. Can you compute the energy momentum tensor of the field, say the energy momentum tensor of the Hawking radiation, and see that through the horizon there is a flux of incoming negative energy?
Yeah, I think that calculation really we could do even before we calculated the evolving quantum state, because that's a calculation, say, of expectation values of operators, the stress energy tensor. And there have been different versions of that calculation that go back in time in the two-dimensional context, you know, back to the work of Christensen and Fulling and so on. And in fact, you know, one further iteration on that was a paper I wrote just a few years back, which was also giving an argument that Hawking radiation is produced not in the small Planckian region, but in an atmosphere region, which was based on the form of that stress tensor. And so I looked at, you know, the form of that stress tensor. So that would be what you, from that perspective, again, you know, going back to Christensen and Fulling, we had expressions for the stress tensors in the two-dimensional case. So in short, I think there is a calculation there which could also be checked as just a calculation of taking the expectation value of the stress tensor explicitly in this evolving state. I think we already know the answer from these other perspectives.
Right. The reason I'm asking is that you might not like it. I gather you don't like it, but if I wonder if this same formula as yours could be used. If you time reverse the metric, you have the white hole. So you can start from a white hole with some energy inside and evolve a state seeing that the energy comes out. And so you have choosing appropriately where you are and the slice of the energy and everything, you can do the physics of the long-living remnant explicitly. If you just allow a quantum gravity transition that sort of flips back the black to white horizon.
Yeah, I think do something like turn these diagrams upside down to describe something like white hole evolution. And you know, that might be a fun thing to do. But let me say something else, by the way.
Well, roughly upside down, yeah.
What's that?
Roughly upside down.
We want to do the appropriate time reversal operation. Let me say something else now that we're on the subject. So here we have a picture of the evolving quantum state of a black hole, and we want to know how it's modified. And I proposed that, you know, maybe there are small quantum gravity modifications to the evolution that go outside of the context of local quantum field theory. I think we probably have to go outside of the context of local quantum field theory. But other folks, you in particular, have argued, well, maybe there are some other kinds of effects that are, you know, maybe even in some sense, big effects, like transition to something that looks like a white hole. So I think one could take this perspective and say, you know, how would we think about transition from this evolving quantum state, maybe improved in terms of including the gravitational field, et cetera, to a white hole like state? And I think you see, if you do that, you see how that's a pretty extreme kind of thing to do. In some sense, it's a big departure from the evolution that we already had taking place, just with what essentially look like they should be small quantum gravity corrections. Now, maybe we motivate it because we only have that happen once the curvatures get Planckian or something like that. But in any case, it's a big correction to this picture. I think you can really see it if you phrase things in terms of this kind of picture.
Well, let's talk in the case in which it might happen when the size of black hole has become Planckian.
Okay. Yeah. If it really becomes Planckian, I would say at least all bets are off in terms of the detailed description of the geometry. But there are still some general constraints. There's a certain number of quantum states. There's an asymptotically measured energy. You know, stuff like that. We believe. But in terms of the detailed description, all bets are off.
Right. So if you allow a small quantum gravity region to do whatever it wants on the basis, you know, that quantum mechanics allows tunneling and transitions.
Well, except, whatever it wants, conserving information, if we're calling
conserving
it
conserving information and conserving
energy, because that's something we measure asymptotically.
And conserving
so there are
the
constraints
energy.
Like that. And those are some of the important ones. But anyway, go ahead.
Right. So then, you know, your slices, here inside, as you say, they can be arbitrarily long, right? It depends. In fact, they can be arbitrarily long in a funny way because look at the picture that you have there. You have the infalling matter.
Yep.
So you have to wait sufficiently long time for the black hole to become big. Do you agree with me in that way of talking? It's a rather imprecise way of talking. In other words, you can have R equal constant slice inside, which is very long, provided that you...
That sounds more like you're describing a nice slice. Actually, this is not quite the right picture for the four-dimensional.
Yeah, because that's a two-dimensional one. You're right.
We really should stop it at R equals zero if we're talking about the...
Exactly.
Classical exactly. description of the higher dimension.
Exactly. But the nice then, the nice goes down. They avoid R equals zero, so they go down and hit the. Oh, you have the pictures of them, yeah.
Yeah.
The nice one goes down, but of course it goes down at some point. It hits the star that is that created the black hole.
Yeah, I haven't completed it, but yeah, you can basically take that into the flat region before the black hole forms itself.
Exactly. So if you want this nice slice to be have a lot of volume, you have to enter late in the horizon.
Well, yeah, I would say just if you, you know, if you have a nice slice like this and you just wait until the black hole is exactly. evaporated to yeah. half its size, it does have a lot of volume. It just does.
Exactly, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Exactly the same. But it comes out very late. I mean, the nice slices that come out earlier are small inside.
Yeah, the they same, have less. Thing. If you track it back to the matter that formed the thing, yeah, they have
exactly,
this
exactly. So that's
here is less long.
Exactly. So one can figuratively say, allow me the language, that as time goes on, the volume inside becomes bigger and bigger. In that sense, in the sense that we just said.
Yeah, there's a sense in which that is true.
Right. So if you do your formalism on this on these slices. The quantum field you have inside has a lot of space to do stuff. So you have to put there something with a lot of information and little energy, as you say. Because I mean, if you get to the end, you have a mic outside the ADM energies. Well, the Bondi energy, whatever. It's a microgram. That's Planck mass. But you have an enormous information if you started with a microscopic black holes, okay? But you have this enormous amount of volume. Now, if you allow this to quantum jump in a white hole, you start from the opposite situation. So you start from a white hole with a small throat, a huge, nice slice, and some field there that has to come out with little energy, a huge amount of information, and a lot of time. And you seem to have the formalism for describing that and seeing whether it is impossible, making concrete or possible. You're saying this is impossible because of arguments.
Yeah, I think one could set that up and try to describe it. I think somehow it's a different, well, the question of the initial state there, if it's a white hole with a huge amount of information in a small mass, well, let's just put it this way. I think there's a question of how to sensibly describe that initial state, which we could get into in this way of looking at it. I think we could try to have, one could have a discussion along those lines. But with
that's what we're trying to do. That's what we're trying to do. So what we're trying to do is the tunneling from the black to white hole using LQG. But then, of course, we are back outside quantum gravity, and that's a problem. That's a quantum field theoretical problem. Is it possible that from, if your quantum gravity lands you to that situation, because as you say correctly, I mean, you have to have conserve information, conserve energy, okay?
Yeah.
But if there's a quantum gravity region, you tunnel through the singularity, and then you have essentially a sort of time reverse situation. It's not really the time reverse situation because you don't have incoming Hawking radiation outside.
But of course, the problem with that, Carlo, is going to be in this picture that what you're describing is a white hole with a Schwarzschild radius of order the Planck scale or something. Yeah. And so really we would say we just don't trust any of this picture down in here. We only trust maybe the picture asymptotically. So we could try to model it, even though we don't absolutely trust that. We could try to model some of that, I think. But we'd have to be a little careful.
Yeah, this is a good point because, so you're saying once we assume that, at the end of the operation, we're in a quantum gravity region Then if you tunnel to a black hole which roughly has the same size, so we're still in a quantum gravity region. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. And so then you might say, well, then, you know, one could try to exploit the fact that not all bets are off, but many bets are off. We could try to exploit, but again, the key word is, you know, many bets are off because there's still some general constraints on that, which, you know, we were alluding to: conservation of information, conservation of energy.
Sure.
And the fact that, you know, if you have a little thing with a mass, which is maybe the Planck mass, you know, it's got to move in a way that's consistent with, well, there's sort of an effective field theory description. It, you know, it gravitates with a Planck mass, and it should be able to fall in the presence of a more massive body, you know, it's going to follow a geodesic, et cetera, et cetera. So there are constraints like that.
Could be dark matter.
If you take into account those constraints, then I think one develops an effective field theory description for these things, and then it's only one step further to get into the infinite or unbounded production problem.
I thought a lot about that. Of course, I read your papers about that. Of course, there is an amount of, the total cross-section is an integral. So of course you can have an integration region which is infinite, but the integral which is finite. It just depends how the probability amplitude depends on the depend on your variables. And the intuition here is that classical theory is a limit of quantum theory. To produce a black hole with a huge inside, you take a long, long time. In the sense that we said before, you cannot generate. Sorry, I have some noise here, which I don't know what it is. Sorry. I hope it stops. Do you hear this noise or?
No.
No, I don't hear it. So just proceed.
To produce a black hole with a huge inside, in the sense that we said before, it takes a long time.
Well, it was the conventional way, but again, well, here we come back to this statement, you know, if it's really a Planckian sized thing, maybe at least many bets are off for its internal dynamics. So, you know, how should we think about that? But anyway, I think that's a longer discussion, and actually I fear that we might be.
Yes, so this potentially could continue for hours since.
I think so. We should continue
Carlo. Yes. You could probably continue the discussion privately. So I think it's a good point to close the discussion, and I would ask all the remaining participants to unmute themselves to thank Steve for his nice talk and discussion.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to visit Perimeter, if only virtually, and everywhere else, wherever everyone else is. So thanks.